want more to eat. Where are we from?
Life is rooted in Death's Republic.
Where are we going?
Our seat returns to Death's Republic. These cheery sentiments should inspire.
Lovely to see you, Maura. Thank you for joining me here today. So I just wanted to maybe go back to the beginning and for you to share with us your earliest memories, really, of Alistair, what it was like growing up with him.
Yeah, fine. Earliest memories. During the war, Alistair, my mother and I left Glasgow to avoid the bombing. And after a few months, I think, in a converted bus, we finished up in a flat in Stonehouse in Lanarkshire. And really, that was when Alistair started school. So he must have been five. So I'd be three. And that's when he became a person for me. We used to escort him across the road and see him into the school gates. And at playtime, as I recall, we used to go across with his piece. So he'd something to eat during the playtime. The flat I remember as being cold, dark, dismal, outside toilet, down outside stairs and across the yard to the toilet. And Alistair managed to catch whooping cough, which he then passed on to me, chicken pox, which he then passed on to me, and measles, which he then passed on to me. So my poor mother had us in this flat. We spent a lot of time together in the box bed off the living room. So that was my earliest memories, really, of Alistair. But then much must have been to my mother's delight. My father got a job as a manager in the munitions workers hostel down in Wetherby in Yorkshire. And we moved from this flat down to a bungalow that was near the countryside. It backed onto a field. And I think the next 4 years were possibly the happiest in the Raleigh or the Gray family. Alistair's growing up was very difficult. Growing up with him was difficult, but he was worse than me because he suffered from asthma, eczema, nightmares, panic attacks, and his vivid imagination didn't help. He was bullied at school. So really, he needed a lot of attention from my mother. So I just floated along in his wake.
And can I go back to, you were saying when you were just in Wetherby, you're saying that's some of the happiest times in your house. Is that something to do with being in the countryside and that connection with nature and Alistair being outside and being healthier in that kind of environment? Or what would you say?
I think it's one, because there were no financial worries, because my dad had a good job. My mother had some help in the house, which was provided due to the hostel. Alistair and I had freedom. We could go outside whenever we wanted. We'd a lot more freedom there. We walked to school together. We played together. We had good times together and as a family. So I think it was just, I mean, when I think of it, I mean, this is during the war. Alistair was much more aware of the war than I was. That was why he had the nightmares. And we would go and watch the aeroplanes going across to Germany or Europe, and they'd leave in the evening to drop their bombs over there, and we'd count them coming back. And all this was going on, but actually in my little life anyway, it was happy and it was peaceful, and I remember them as happy times. It was when Alistair lived in his imagination. I was quite happy with life as it was, so I didn't need an imagination. I had his imagination to keep me going as well. But
and did he engage you in that world that he was kind of creating? Were you sort of
eventually
participant, or?
I remember it more when we got back to Glasgow. There was one incident in Wetherby which I think kind of illustrates our characteristics and why life got much more volatile and much more difficult when we returned up to Glasgow to the flat. because while we were in Wetherby, I was sent, I don't know by whom, a very big straw hat. It was a lovely with embroidery on it. And I brought my friend back from school to show her this hat. Alasdair was in the bungalow before me. He would not let me in to get the hat. It was too good to come outside. He shouted at me. But he went and got it and he held it up in front of the window. I, who was so angry and frustrated, just pushed my hand right through the window, blood everywhere. I mean, we were both in trouble then. I don't quite remember, possibly didn't want to remember what happened after all that. But I think it showed that at times Alasdair came the big brother, wanted to be superior, maybe because he was bullied at school. It was nice having a little sister that he could be dominant on. And my only way of dealing with Alasdair was physical, because he could beat me with words every time.
Yeah.
But so I would lamb out. So when we went back to Glasgow into the flat there, and my dad was unemployed, there were worries with the parents, obviously. Alasdair always said that was when we started competing for warmth, for space, and for love. We're in competition then. Glasgow was, it was a difficult time. It was a difficult time. And it varied as we went on. Whenever I think we went our own ways, really, in Glasgow when we were older teenagers. Whenever he was at art school and I eventually went to Dunfermline College of Physical Education, because the only thing I was better at Alasdair at were physical things. So that was all that was left for me to do. And that was when we became very good friends. And this caring, loving, companionable relationship grew up until he died, actually. But yes, the Glasgow ones were interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess at that time he was starting to map out ideas for Lanark, wasn't he?
Oh, do you
remember that? Or what do you remember in terms of him? Because, you know, he's spoken a lot, right, about the formative experience of books on him as a child, not only going to the library, but obviously you had books and access to them in your house too. But I got the impression of him being his head stuck in this book, his big imagination, trying to draw and wrangle these worlds around him. And like, what was he, you know, producing a lot, drawing a lot, writing? What do you remember? Was he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. He was, with his stories and pictures. No, whenever I think of Alasdair with his writing and his pictures, again, they were happy times. They were happy times. I must read you this bit from Endnotes. You know, in every short story, there's endnotes. And this is what Alasdair wrote. Maura did not interest me as a person, being 2 years younger and a girl. But until I was 13 or more, I needed her as much as I have needed a public for my books. So I was necessary to him. He tried his writing out on me. He did, as he says in Lanark, that is completely true. He was in one bedroom, I was in the other bedroom, and he shouted the bedtime stories through to me. I didn't need to bother to read. Alasdair shouted the bed. He got very angry with me the next day because I'd fallen asleep, and he was still, all his words were being ignored because I'd fallen asleep and I was in trouble the next day, and where he'd got to try and find out where to start again. So he also, with the drawing, my mother had an old autograph book, big autograph book, which she gave Alasdair to draw in. And Alasdair eventually gave it to me, and he illustrated the stories that he told me in this book. There were floating islands. There was Wobble, the Diplodocus, who had all sorts of adventures. And these were illustrated in that book. Unfortunately, and very much to my regret, that book had a bad ending. Alasdair wrote in one of his letters later on, "Do you remember a picture in that funny album I gave you when we were in our early teens? The album with the finger ink stain in the middle of each page, which I did out of spite during one of our quarrels. NB, note, the blend of sadism and masochism in that gesture. I damaged your present by damaging my work. So that is him, his memory of it. Neither of us can remember what happened to that poor old album. But yes, that was his starting. I mean, he always wanted to write and illustrate. That's all he ever wanted to do.
And you were always blind, right? The connection between the word and image was there from the start, right? It wasn't, like you're saying, he was illustrating the stories that he was narrating.
No, there was
separation, right? They were always together.
No, they were always both there. I remember his, when he went to art school, and I remember him doing his homework and his painting there. And I managed to save one of his works, his picture of Tam O'Shanter. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Because once he'd finished that, my father criticised it and Alasdair was just going to rip it up. Mm-hmm. So I managed to stop him doing that and actually eventually gave it to my husband Bert and I as a wedding present. So we've still got Tam O'Shanter here, which is a joy. I don't remember him saying anything about Lanark, but he did write to me. Again, he was great with letters, but he never put the date on, or he seldom put the date on. But this is one of his letters from him, about, and it does mention Lanark. However, I had more, I think Inga and Andrew had gone on holiday. However, I had more time to concentrate on my work. By the end of a fortnight, I had bought and begun reading several new books, which were helping me to think clearly about parts of the tan-tan-ta-ra great book that I'm writing. Actually, I've been writing it for years, since I was 18, in fact. And yes, I will get it finished soon, by 1974 or 75 at the latest. Three chapters of it have been published in a literary magazine up here. And as a result, together with something on radio and regular exhibiting, I have become a foostie-wee Scottish celebrity, which is soothing. Isn't that just Alasdair?
Yeah, it is, and also that idea of deadlines, right? Even from an early stage. By at least by 1974, 75.
That's right. And in other letters that it came through. But yes, I mean, I remember he was just very good with words and very good with, he just loved them. He loved them.
So were you privy to any sections of Lanark before that it was published, or when it was finally published? Was that your first opportunity to see what he did?
That was when the first time, I mean, I was aware all the way through that it was happening, because in his letters he would say it might be published this time, whatever.
When did you first read Lanark then? Was that after it was published?
Yes, yeah. It was after it was published. It was when it came through the door on the 18th, is it? I've got it written down somewhere. Sharing Lanark, no. I was in Stevenage. I mean, I was 44 years of age. I had two teenagers, or both teenagers' daughters. And this came through the door and I read it. Here we are. I'm trying to find where I've written it. Oh, dear. Here we go. Here we are. I read it in 4 days. It was just, actually, I don't know if it's worthwhile, Sorsha. I kept a journal in my days.
Dang.
And I can read from the journal
privilege more. I'd love that.
Would that be all right?
Absolutely, please do.
Because probably it was written when my memories were bright. Mm-hmm. Here we are. It was written on the 22nd of February, 1981. Last Wednesday, Lanark arrived through the door, and I have now read it. On Tuesday evening, Tracy and I head for Glasgow, and Katrina joins us for the launching celebrations. How I pray that many, many people read Lanark and like it and cannot put it down just as I couldn't. I realise I cannot give an objective criticism of the book. I only know how I felt as I read it. I wanted to know what happened to the hero and how everything would turn out for him. I objected to putting the book down to go to bed, work, etc., and was very pleased to find that it was so easy to read and understand. I probably missed the deeper meanings, but I'm not sure that it matters. A book should appeal to all kinds of readers. I am a simple one. I found it very upsetting to find out how unhappy Alasdair had been as a child and how thoughtless I was. I kept realising who Alasdair was writing about and got fact and fiction muddled up. I cried so much when my mum died and was so sorry that I had not made life more bearable for Alasdair. He seemed to have so few people who understood his problems, worries and longings. I do not think my mother would have enjoyed this book. I'm not sure that I did. It's not a happy book. I found that every word seemed necessary and only once did anything jar. When Dad and I were supposed to be going to Zermatt climbing. Sky, yes. Zermatt, no. I also wonder how it must feel to open yourself completely to the world, to anyone who wants to read the book. It must make one feel very naked and vulnerable. And I wonder if it was done to finally make a mark on all those people who had ignored him or not given him the attention he thought he deserved.
Wow, what an entry, Martin. That's amazing. And I mean, obviously it's a hard book for you to read too, because you can see that obviously the autobiographical element, not just of Alistair and what he was struggling with, but by proxy you and your parents too. So
yes, books two and three are the ones that I identify most with. But I'm reading Lanark again. I think this is my fourth time. And even in the other books, there's sections which you think, yeah, that's just what my dad would do, or that's just what, it comes through all the way through. And yes, it's quite an emotional book to read.
I can imagine. But
so are some of his others, but I think that's the most, excuse me. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you talk about that then, his motivation for working on that, and in some way that acknowledgement that I guess you're saying was lacking for many people as a boy with him growing up, being bullied, being sort of sickly, and that need to have some sort of love or recognition in a way.
Yes. Well, he felt unloved and unlovable. Mm-hmm. He knew my mother loved him. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Alasdair was such a... My mother and father at times must both have wondered, what have we brought into this world? I mean, if you remember the bit, and this was the bit in Lanark I absolutely hated, the bit where Alasdair is not eating.
Yes, it's hard.
And meal times were fraught.
Yeah.
Not just Alasdair, me as well.
Yeah.
And it was always, you know, your mother's done this, and there's children starving in China, and Alasdair would, I mean, I wouldn't get into the state Alasdair would get into about the food. But that part in where my father is thrashing Alasdair for not eating this food. My father was friendly, lovely, lovable. I was probably closer to my dad than I was to my mum, because mum spent so much time with Alasdair. And Alasdair was not at all interested in sports. So I was the one that went to the football matches and went climbing with dad and horse racing when we were in Wetherby. So I was probably closer to him. I got the belt from him as well across my buttocks but I always knew what I was being punished for. And there were things that, I mean, really, a child should not throw a boot brush at their mother. It fortunately missed my mum and went through a window, but that wasn't very good either. But it was always, you wait till your father comes back. So poor dad would come back tired after a day's work and have to chastise me because I'd done something wrong. And reading it now, it seems cruel and abusive. But in those days, I was getting the belt every day at school because of bad teaching. Mm-hmm. Not because I was stupid, but because the teacher was a bad teacher. And as a result, I got the belt. So this was it. Spare the rod and spoil the child was there.
Absolutely. And that idea of control. And now we're much more tuned in with trauma and damage, and not just physical, psychological, how that affects a person's favorite. You're, yeah, I mean, to look back at that for many people who have had no experience of it, I think it must seem like an alien place. But for many people, that was just, as you said, you, your parents would discipline you that way. Schools were disciplining you that way. That was just an accepted form, wasn't it? So
I never felt traumatized by it at all. I just accepted it. With getting the belt at school, it was because I couldn't do long division of money. Mm-hmm. My father, I mean, this is at 10. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, whenever we stop getting taught that, then I'll stop getting the belts. My poor dad tried to teach me, but he couldn't. Yeah. And it was the same. It was easier to have a slap and it was done with, particularly if you knew what it was for. Mm-hmm. You know, it was done with rather than something else being worked out. But these sections, I found very difficult to read about. And it's, as I said, I really get fact and fiction muddled up at times. So I will, in my imagination, when I'm reading the book, I will embroider other happenings that are not mentioned in the book.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, pick them up. Sections that Alistair's written about are, like, any truth is a remembered version, isn't it? It's obviously altered in the process of thinking back to it and writing it, and where you were there, you know, from what happened then to where he was as a young man writing it. It's been sort of distorted or developed in that process too.
Yes, I could accept that he changed places. I mean, actually, I mean, the tenement, that was absolutely as it was, and. But for instance, the hostel was not near a loch, it was down in Wetherby. I can accept the juxtaposition of places. The gas fire is quite true as well. Mum did have the gas fire taken out because the other person had committed suicide in it. But it was the people that I found it was more difficult to accept. I mean, I did talk to Alistair about it. And the bullying from him, I didn't look upon it as bullying, just superiority. Mm-hmm. Superiority, that was it. That did happen. And he apologises in so many of these later letters that he wrote to me. I'm so sorry that I bullied you when you were young, you know, this kind of thing came along. But he did steal the sugar. He definitely did steal the sugar, but I watched him through the window. That was absolutely true. Oh dear. And
talking about, you're saying when you up in Glasgow, Alistair's at art school, you were studying too, and then almost you're becoming your own people at that point, and you're entering into your own lives, that you were then in a way came back together and connected, because you've some of the letters that you wrote to each other over the years, which when I was looking through Alistair's items in his flat, I found that so moving. Your file was the biggest file, more of the correspondence that he saved between the two of you with lovely such fondness. So
I mean I reread through all his letters just a couple of days ago, and they started really, must have been whenever I moved from, I got married the day after I left college. So that was 1958. And I stayed up in Aberdeen for a few years after that. But it was whenever we moved down to Stevenage in Hertfordshire. Bert got a job which we thought was going to be an East School bride, and it finished up in Stevenage, Hertfordshire, which why we finished down there and not in Scotland, much to my, never mind, that's another story. But that was when the letters started. And yes, they are very, I enjoyed writing letters and I loved receiving them. Most of Alistair's letters starts with an apology for not replying sooner. He found letter writing difficult because I think he felt he had to compose. He was a writer, so it had to be not just the letters I would write, which worries me, because a lot of the things that he writes about are really very personal. So I wonder what I wrote in mine. I had no idea he was saving them until it was when he was wheelchair bound and I was trying to help him tidy up some papers, as there were always piles of papers on his desk. And he said, well, that's from you, put it in your file. I couldn't, you know, no. And he kept all Tracy's, all Katrina's. Yeah. And this is, I think, crumbs, what did I write? I mean, my journal can be exceedingly miserable at times because I only wrote in it when I had to get rid of angst. You know, that was a way to get rid of anything. Yeah. So I sometimes worry about what happened. Yeah, what happens with all these letters. But they were lovely. They were great. Except some were exceedingly sad. Interesting, two that came late in 1981. I think you asked whether Alasdair seemed relieved when mm-hmm. that ran.
Yeah.
Are really, really sad. His personal life was not happy then. And financially, it was not good then. So that's just a few months after Lanark was published. But I think...
carry on.
No. As Unlikely Stories came along quite quickly afterwards, didn't it? So, yeah.
Just thinking about that determination, you know, to take 30 years to make something and, you know, to be stoic and... your vision for it, so other people had suggested different ways or editing it or how you could make it, I guess, more commercial in a sense or more publishable, but he had this fierce sort of vision, and then it comes out, and you know, like anything, it's like, it's not like he then had imminent financial or other success, you know, there was lots going on, as you're saying, and the relief in some way of letting that go and putting it out there. But then also when I was speaking in the last programme with Alan Riek, he was saying it was so new and so shocking in a way, Lanark, that almost those things are unpalatable and it takes a while for people to digest and understand just important they are. It's like anything new that's not always met with plaudits and accolade. It takes time for that to really filter through. And you know, just thinking about that, how you put something like that with that emotional investment out there and aftermath almost of it.
Yes.
So do you were at the launch?
We used to go, never Alasdair had an exhibition or anything, we'd always try to be there, to be with him. But Bert didn't come up, my husband didn't come, but Tracy and I went up from Stevenage, and Katrina at this time was in Manchester University, so we met. And we went to the launch, yes. I think my big joy was just seeing Andrew, Katrina and Tracy all together and happy. Mm-hmm. And their big memory would be introduced to Billy Connolly, who was there. And Alasdair introduced them to Billy Connolly and their photographs taken by Billy Connolly. I mean, that was what was important to them. Have you seen the copy of the... invitation?
Yes,
that is absolutely brilliant. It's this a frequently announced novel by Alasdair Gray. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Yes, we went up there, it was great. So yeah, once again I wrote in my journal about it, so I've got that, and the joy is, it was, I remember one time just standing aside, and I think this happened at a lot of these later launches and things, I would just stand aside and watch everybody being animated and excited. Always felt slightly out of it, but it was, I just wanted him to be successful. I just wanted people to like his work and enjoy his work, and that's been the case all the way, really. We went in the evening as well because there was Carl McDougall was mm-hmm. reading poetry in the evening at the Third Eye Centre. And again, is it all right if I go back to this journal?
Such a journal.
This is when Alasdair was reading from Lanark. He chose the part from book 4, where Lanark is trying to find work to provide for Rima and Alexander. It's received with great appreciation and mirth and seems so much funnier than when I read it. This is probably why I found it was a sad book. I was too emotionally involved with it. I still don't understand all the allegories, but I revel in the audience's appreciation of Alasdair's writing. And I think that was the whole thing for me, for the launch and for everything. It was the fact that all the people there were there because they liked, and they might not have appreciated totally then, but they were people who they were Alice Dance friends. And it was lovely seeing there were friends of my mum and dad were there as well, old friends from them, friends of Alice Dance that I hadn't seen since I was wee, and they were coming to the house and I was banned from the bedroom where they met because I was just, you know, two years younger and a girl. So
that's the way. Mm-hmm. And do you, Maura, do you have a favourite section in Lanark that you like?
I do. I must say, I've also, as well as all Asda's letters, which I've saved, I've got now 10 volumes of cuttings. Mm. I started in 1951, keeping cuttings. Number 10 is not going to get very good because Alasdair used to send them to me humbly and with apologies, but he wanted them to be kept somewhere and I could keep them.
You need to compare them.
Yes. Yes, I have my...
Yeah,
this is the book that fell through the door.
Yeah, did he sign it for you?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
To my sister with love, hoping she likes it, from Alasdair, 8th of February 1981. Also with thanks for help in a difficult time. You often had difficult times financially. So, but the bit I've chosen, and I have to warn you, I don't often get to the end without tears appearing. But Alasdair also read it on a recording that he sent me. So if I don't get through it, you'll be able to hear Alasdair reading it on Alasdair Gray rereads that Katrina's doing.
Yeah.
But it's the bit, it's from book 4, and it's the part where... there you go, it's gone. I was going to say where Alasdair is going as the provost of Unthank, but it of course is Mr. Thor, isn't it, who's going. As provost of Unthank, he's going to a council meeting and he's in an aircraft of some kind. And it's from there. And I've chosen it because it's got description in it, which I think Alasdair was brilliant at, and it's got memories for me. He was flying up a wide and winding firth with very different coasts. To the right lay green farmland with clumps of trees and reservoirs in hollows linked by quick streams. On the left were mountain ridges and high bends silvered with snow, the sun striking gold sparks off bits of sea loch between them. On both shores, he saw summer resorts with shops, church spires and crowded esplanades, and changing ports with harbours full of shipping. Tankers moved on the water, and freighters and white-sailed yachts. A long curving feather of smoke pointed up at him from a paddle steamer, churning with audible chunking sounds toward an island big enough to hold a grouse moor, two woods, 3 farms, a golf course, and a town fringing a bay. This island looked like a bright toy he could lift up off the smoothly ribbed, rippling sea, and he seemed to recognize it. He thought, did I have a sister once? And did we play together on the grassy top of that cliff among the yellow gorse bushes? Yes, on that cliff, behind the Marine Observatory, on the day like this in the summer holidays. Did we bury a tin, under a gorse bush in a rabbit hole? There was a half crown piece in it and a silver sixpence dated from that year and a piece of our mother's jewellery and a cheap little notebook with a message to ourselves when we grew up. Did we promise to dig it up in 25 years' time? And did we dig it up 2 days later to make sure it hadn't been stolen? And were we not children then? And was I not happy?
Well, that was amazing reading to end. Podcast. It's such a privilege to talk to you and to share and reminisce about someone who meant so much to so many, but particularly to you. So what a privilege. I I'm saying it now because I've recorded it, but we definitely will be getting you back for more down the line, because it is just not only to have your personal take on it, but the, you know, your diaries and your letters and that kind of rich resource in terms of you, those memories from that time that you've got stored as well in some form. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Absolutely. What a privilege. Thank you, Maura.
I've always felt that stories and pictures were a way of keeping people I knew alive and as they were.